This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's a thumbnail sketch of how the American economy works. Consumers get in their cars, drive to the store, and buy stuff. But not only are we not buying cars, we're not buying the stuff now either. Retail sales dropped another notch today. Detroit is still looking for help. And the credit crisis? Yeah, it's still happening. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
From the studios of WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 6th of November today. Great to have you with us. The way things have been going, I don't know if you could rightly call today's retail sales numbers a slap in the face. They sure were bracing, though, as much for what the actual numbers were as for what they say about us. Detroit is saying, help, please. We'll update their latest bid for a bailout. And you know what else nobody's buying besides retail goods and cars? Loans. A refresher course in the virtues of securitization coming up. First, though, we have to get through the downer that is the retail sector. Last month, retail stores in this country had their worst showing in more than 30 years. It's not just the thrifty who are avoiding the malls. Sales at luxury stores tumbled hard, too, down nearly 20% from a year ago. A lot of that could have to do with smaller stock portfolios, I guess. But Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports it looks like there's a psychological shift underway as well.
Call it the new frugality. Walmart was the sole bright spot in a month of dismal sales. That couldn't be worse news for luxury retailers like Saks, which posted nearly a 17% drop in sales last month. Michael Namira is chief economist with the International Council of Shopping Centers, and he says even the richest consumers have limits.
One is the ability to spend, and two is the willingness. And it's really the willingness to spend that has been shaken at the high end.
Diminishing stock portfolios may be one reason that willingness has declined, but Mary Lou Quinlan of the marketing firm Just Ask a Woman has this explanation.
You look as if you're, you know, flaunting in the face of financial ruin.
Quinlan says there's a growing recognition among consumers, even those with the fattest wallets, that they went too far. Harvard marketing professor Nancy Kane says that realization may reshape America's retail landscape.
This is a great moment of reckoning for the household economy at all levels of the income stream.
She says the days of conspicuous consumption are gone, but Target's $50 knockoffs of $1,200 designer handbags isn't necessarily what shoppers will be snapping up.
My own best guess, if you made me bet on it, would be that we'll see value being much more tightly associated with home, family, hearth. Things that seem stable when a lot around us feels uncertain.
Kane says that means gifts like bake-at-home cookie sets and candlesticks will be much more popular this season than flat-screen TVs and $800 shoes. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Chief executives from General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler were on Capitol Hill today, hats in hand. The car makers are running out of cash, as we've told you. That has made them just about desperate to get their hands on billions in government loans. But what do you suppose would happen if lawmakers said no? Marketplace's Jeff Tyler considers the consequences of letting one of the big three fail.
Congress has already promised automakers a $25 billion loan, but Dave McCurdy with the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers says it has strings attached and may come too late.
That money, even though approved by Congress and signed by the president, is yet to flow. So during this short-term liquidity crisis, companies are trying to gain access to that.
Congress is considering a second $25 billion loan that could be available earlier. McCurdy doesn't believe the new administration will allow a major car company to fail.
As President-elect Obama is trying to restore confidence in the financial markets, restore confidence in a turnaround of the economy, having a major bankruptcy of one of the largest manufacturers in the country would be devastating.
Devastating or not, management professor Gerald Myers at the University of Michigan favors industrial Darwinism.
A company should be allowed to fail, but the social costs of doing so need to be considered.
About 600,000 employees work directly for a car company or supplier. Add in those who are indirectly tied to the industry, and we're talking more than 3.5 million jobs.
To just let a car company go, you know, as a lesson or something, is going to be a price that's too high for the nation to pay.
That's Jim Hall, an auto analyst with 2953 Analytics. He says a bankrupt car company could drag down the entire manufacturing sector. Hall points to 2006 data showing which country makes the most money from exports.
Not China, not Japan, not Britain. It was Germany. And it's because Germany as a nation understood the importance of maintaining manufacturing.
Hall agrees with Dave McCurdy at the Trade Association on this point.
Allowing one or more manufacturers to collapse will cost taxpayers significantly more in the long run than helping them weather this liquidity crisis.
But even government loans may not ensure survival. Car sales plunged by more than a third last month. Ford and GM release corporate earnings tomorrow. Both companies are expected to show billions of dollars in losses and announce more job cuts as they fight for their lives. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Over the course of this credit crisis, we have all learned way more than we'd care to about how mortgages are sliced and diced and turned into bonds. That process of packaging those loans is called securitization. And it's not just mortgages. Car loans, credit card debt, even student loans are securitized and sold off. Usually sold pretty fast, too, so banks can turn around and issue more loans. Problem is, investors' appetite for that kind of debt, or bonds, has practically disappeared. Ashley Milne-Tite reports that can only mean bad things for the economy.
The investors who usually buy so-called asset-backed bonds do so because they get a decent interest rate in return. But they've stopped buying. Some are worried that people won't make their payments in a declining economy. Others simply haven't got the cash to invest. Hugh Johnson is CEO of Johnson Illington Advisors. He says banks and other financial companies that make car, student, and credit card loans are now in a bind.
If they can't package those into securities and sort of offload them to investing institutions, then they have to bear the risk of owning those loans themselves. And if someone defaults on those loans, it will affect, obviously, the earnings of that bank.
When faced with defaults, banks usually sell off bad loans to third-party debt collectors at deep discounts. But Matt Fabian of Municipal Market Advisors says even that market is having problems.
The companies who buy these delinquent loans are having difficulty getting credit themselves. So they're not coming up with the resources in which they can purchase delinquent loans from the credit card companies, from the auto loan companies.
Meaning those companies and banks are stuck with the bad loans. So Fabian says they're doing everything they can to reduce their risk when they make a loan. That means they're lending a lot less, and that's affecting everyone.
Reduced credit means reduced consumer spending, and that's a deflationary input into the economy.
If people can't borrow money to spend, in other words, the economy's just going to get worse. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
You could have taken yesterday's ticker tape and just run it through the machine again. Wall Street gave up another 5% today, pretty much all the way around. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Barack Obama has made the first hire of his new administration. Democratic officials confirmed today that Chicago Congressman Rahm Emanuel has signed on as Obama's chief of staff. That makes it one down, hundreds of top jobs left to fill, and 10 weeks to do it, which poses a distinctly political question. Some of the best qualified applicants for those jobs, people who've been around Washington for a long time and know how it works, are lobbyists, or they have ties to them. But since Obama spent all that time bashing lobbyists while he was out on the campaign trail, how's he going to turn around now and hire them? From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser reports.
Lobbyists were a convenient political football for Obama during the presidential campaign. He served up some anti-lobbyist rhetoric just last month to a cheering crowd.
They will not run my White House. You'll help me run my White House when I'm president.
Obama has said he'll restrict the role of lobbyists in his White House. Is that realistic? New York University professor Paul Light says probably not. He's an expert on presidential transitions.
You can't throw a rock in Washington and not hit somebody who isn't benefiting in some way by lobbying within their organization.
But do you want them a stone's throw away from the Oval Office? Steve Elmendorf says maybe. He's a Democratic lobbyist.
There are labor lobbyists, there are environmental lobbyists that have substantive expertise on the issues that you're trying to deal with.
Stephen Hess of the Brookings Institution says if you exclude lobbyists, you'll have a hard time getting anything done.
You could bring in all sorts of terrific people, but they don't necessarily know, let's say, how to get a bill through Congress.
What's the solution? NYU's Paul Light says Obama is likely to use a narrow definition of who's a lobbyist. He would exclude only those who formally registered as lobbyists with Congress. Light says Obama isn't likely to broaden the definition to include, say, lawyers who aren't registered lobbyists themselves, but whose firms lobby. If he did,
he probably wouldn't be able to recruit an administration.
And that would be a problem. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
As I mentioned up at the top of the broadcast, we've come to Baltimore today to continue with fallout. That's our coverage of the financial crisis and, increasingly, its aftermath. Out here, away from Wall Street and Washington, is where the loop gets closed, where the connections between the crisis and the real world are made. You can get a pretty good snapshot of the Baltimore economy if you spend an afternoon in the emergency room at the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center.
We had a number of fractures. We had a number of elderly people who had fallen and injured themselves. We had strokes. We had a couple of heart attacks.
Dr. Hugh Hill's in the middle of a 12-hour shift at Bayview. He's on his way to seeing maybe 170 patients today. Between the university and its hospital system, Johns Hopkins is the biggest private employer in Baltimore. For years, until the tech boom and the migration of a lot of those higher-skill, higher-paying jobs closer to Washington, D.C., Baltimore was the economic engine for the whole state of Maryland.
The southeast corner of Baltimore is the area where the famous Bethlehem Steel Plant was. And there was a lot of heavy industry in the area, both associated with Bethlehem Steel and Bethlehem itself. And even though they've closed down and the local GM plant has closed down, there's still industry here and there's still a patient population here that depend on that industry.
Those patients depend on Bayview so much that the hospital's been filled almost to capacity. 90% of the beds are taken.
His lungs are probably very tight. His bronchial tubes have tightened down.
More than half of the patients admitted to Bayview come in first through the ER. And Hill says the crush has only gotten worse as the credit crisis and the economy have collided.
It shows up here in that people are coming in who have jobs that they're desperate not to lose. They don't want to report that the injury was on the job. It happens because they come in, they've lost their job, healthcare starts to go down, depression sets in, and it is noticeable here.
One of the things that's going to be happening that will affect Hopkins and other facilities is our ability to pay doctors through the Medicaid program as adequately as we'd like.
Like a lot of other states, as consumer spending has slowed and tax revenues have dried up, Maryland's been having some money problems. Walter Deschino runs the legislature's nonpartisan budget office. The state is looking for almost $400 million in cuts for this fiscal year.
Well, it's like the old saying about Frank Sutton, the bank robber, you go where the money is. And one of the biggest chunks of money that is identified with a single program in any state is going to be the Medicaid program.
Overall, healthcare spending in Maryland is going to lose $85 million this year. That's an amount that Hugh Hill, the ER doctor, says he's resigned to, but still.
In this particular crisis, there may be some other people hurt before us, folks that can't make payments on mortgages and wind up out in the street. And in any kind of a recession, you worry about people that become jobless. But one of the spin-off results is that more and more people wind up in the emergency room because it is the one place that they can go.
It's also, especially in states that are cutting their budgets, one of the most expensive ways there is to get health care. Coming up, how computers are going to rule our lives.
Pretty soon, it doesn't matter if the machine is smarter than you. You've been absorbed into the operating system, as it were, the matrix, and now you're just a part of it.
But first, let's do the numbers. Why did the Dow Industrials lose another 443 points today? Well, one analyst blames the, quote, downward spiral of negative feedback, unquote, including worsening retail and jobs numbers. Whatever. It all pushed the blue chip index down another 4.8%, back below the 9,000 mark for a close of 8,695. The Nasdaq slid 72 points, 4 1/3%, finished at 1608. The S&P 500 dropped 47 points, 5%, ended at 904. A big black cloud descended over Blackstone Group after the world's biggest private equity company reported its biggest quarterly loss since it went public just a year and a half ago. Shares lost more than 12% today. Things went from bad to worse for American car makers. General Motors shares plunged another 13%. Ford stock lost more than 5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Cleveland Clinic, committed to providing health and wellness services through its executive health program at clevelandclinic.org/executive health. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The U.S. Labor Department releases the unemployment report for October. The National Association of Realtors announces their monthly pending home sales index. And from the Federal Reserve Board, the September report on consumer credit. Also, the 11th annual chocolate show begins in New York. We could all use a little more chocolate in our lives. I'm Allison Gilbert.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Since that Election Day bounce on Tuesday, up 305, the Dow is off more than 900 points, pretty much the same percentage-wise on the NASDAQ and the S&P. There are, of course, a thousand things that can put pressure on stocks. Sometimes they're pretty straightforward, like today's report on retail sales. But often the reasons stocks decline are more obscure. One of the obscure ones we've been hearing a lot about lately is the margin call. Here's Bill Radke with the latest installment in our explainer series, The Marketplace Decoder.
Let's say it's 2007. The stock market keeps going up and up. The Dow is at an all-time high, and you go to a party.
Is this a line for the bathroom?
Yeah.
Thanks. I'm Tom, by the way. I'm an average radio listener.
Hi, Tom. I'm Sarah. I'm a stockbroker.
Oh, man. I wish I could buy more stocks, but I don't have enough cash.
Oh, I'll lend you some money.
You will? Just like that? Don't I need to put anything down?
Yeah, you put some down, I'll lend you the rest, and I'll use the stock you buy as your collateral.
Well, gee, what could go wrong? Okay.
Congratulations. You're about to buy on margin. Now, Sarah the stockbroker is smart.
Thanks.
She's going to make sure there's a cushion between what your stock is worth and what you owe her. That cushion is your margin requirement. Think of it as your margin of error. Your stock can only go down a certain amount before you get a call from Sarah.
Hello. Your stock has gone down. This is your margin call.
And that means she wants more collateral. That could be cash, stocks, whatever she'll accept. You pump that into your margin account, reinflate that cushion, and you hang on and hope your stock goes back up. But what if the market keeps going down? You and other investors keep getting margin calls, and the securities you're selling to cover your margin keep dropping in value, which means more margin calls and more losses.
And now that can accelerate the decline.
Doug Grantz is with the investment group Research Affiliates.
If your whole basket of stocks that you would use as collateral is going down in value, you might not have the opportunity to pay the margin call to keep your stocks, and therefore the broker would have to sell them, furthering fuel for a declining market.
And down we go.
Continually. Yeah, it kind of gets a momentum to it.
And that is how margin calls can sometimes make a bad stock market worse. In conclusion, when you buy on margin, you're leveraging. So if you bet right, you magnify your gains, and if you bet wrong, your losses are magnified too. So if you want to play the market with borrowed money, by all means, buy on margin. Just make sure you bet right. I'm Bill Radke for Marketplace.
With the election come and gone, America can finally turn its attention to things that really matter, like football. All right, hear me out, because the sport does share something with the president-elect. Obama used cell phone technology to revolutionize presidential campaigning. Tonight, Sprint and the National Football League hope to revolutionize sports broadcasting via the cell phone. Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports.
My friend John's a football freak. When he gets a call on his T-Mobile cell phone, the Monday Night Football theme plays. But if John was a Sprint customer, for $15 a month, he could now use his phone to get more than ringtones.
Tonight, we will offer the first full-length NFL game telecast live on a phone.
That's Sprint spokesperson Dave Moline. He says this broadcast represents the future of the cell phone industry.
We believe that offering exclusive content, that's the driving force behind what we're going to be offering starting tonight. And I think that will be not only true with Sprint, but probably with other carriers as well.
The key word is exclusive. Content folks can only get from one wireless carrier. But not everyone agrees that's the way wireless media is headed. Kent German is senior editor at CNET.com.
I think the real future is services that you can get on a lot of different carriers.
Google's Android software may be the key to that. German says in the future, lots of cell phones could have it, offered by lots of different wireless carriers. All of those phones could grab content from third parties, like music from Amazon.com. Meanwhile, though, Sprint's Dave Moline hopes NFL games will set his company apart from the competition.
We believe is a difference maker. It's a differentiator for us.
Congratulations on not using the cliche of calling it a game changer.
In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Football on your cell phone is good fun, and maybe eventually it'll be good business, too. But the bigger point here is that the speed of technology never really slows down. Practically as soon as you buy a computer or an iPod or a smartphone, it's out of date. Annoying if you just shelled out a couple of $100 or more. But that rate of progress also takes us a step closer to a more fantastic technology, AI, or artificial intelligence. Computers that act like people. Really, really smart people. Richard Dooling explores how far we are from AI in our everyday lives in his latest book, Rapture for the Geeks. Richard, welcome to the program.
Yes, thanks.
Explain the difference, would you, between really smart computers and actual artificial intelligence?
Well, it depends who you talk to. I mean, the two schools of artificial intelligence are futurists and experts who believe in something called strong artificial intelligence, meaning the computer actually is a brain and will someday be capable of thought and speech. Contrast that with the weak AI people. They look at a box full of chips and memory circuits and say, why would that ever do anything other than exactly what it's told to do?
Yeah, but we've got a sort of weak AI already, right? If I log on to Amazon.com and go book shopping, it's going to tell me what I should like. I can practically pick a mate, right, based on
sure.
computer.
Sure. Oh, input. Match.com and eHarmony, they pick your spouse, and Netflix picks your movies. And pretty soon it doesn't matter if the machine is smarter than you. You've been absorbed into the operating system, as it were, the matrix, and now you're just a part of it.
But there is a functional difference between really smart machines and computers that think for themselves, isn't there?
Yes, so far. We don't know if computers are going to be able to think for themselves. And then, of course, you just start rehashing arguments about what does think mean and what is consciousness that we've been struggling with since ancient Greece. So in order to stay away from those kinds of arguments, a lot of people just look at the computer and say, when will we be on the phone with a personality and be unable to tell, is it a computer or is it a person? Or the easiest example of what is called the Turing test is to just be texting two personalities. One's a human and one is a computer intelligence, and be functionally unable to tell the difference between the two.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, the whole texting thing could conceivably be happening. When I log onto my computer and get a hold of my, I don't know, this actually happened to me, my cable company, and it was easier for me at that point to be texting with them. It could easily have been some computer and doing customer support.
Sure. They call them chatterbots, in fact. And it's, as you can imagine, I mean, the longer we go, computers are doubling in power, speed, capacity every 2 years, according to Moore's law. And so what you're seeing now is going to be twice as good 2 years from now.
Obviously, there are huge corporate uses for this. I mean, companies could really make a whole lot of money if they could just get some really smart computers out there.
Yes, but some people would argue that these derivatives that are causing all the problems on Wall Street, it's a situation where only the computers are smart enough to understand how derivatives work and how to trade them. And so we have, in effect, handed over our economic well-being to computer trading services, and look where it's gotten us. The humans are on Capitol Hill just trying to figure it out right
now.
That's right. Maybe Warren Buffett is the only one that – Warren Buffett and the supercomputers are the only ones that really understand it.
If Warren Buffett is, in fact, human. I mean, you never know, right?
Good point.
The book by Richard Dooling is called Rapture for the Geeks, When AI Outsmarts IQ. Mr. Dooling, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note from Baltimore today. If you find yourself here with some time to kill, the folks over at the National Aquarium would sure appreciate it if you'd swing on by.
Two adults, please.
Two adults. What package are we getting?
Just the aquarium admission.
Right? Two adults.
One adult, one senior, $42.90 for David Eames and Donna Hutton. Eames says if they hadn't planned the trip months ago, before the economy really went in the tank, they might not have come.
It's a pretty big splurge. I mean, it's not something that I would do every day.
Molly Sheehan's the communications director for the biggest tourist attraction in the state of Maryland. Attendance and revenue are basically flat over last year, she says, even though they do still have to pay the bills.
We have to run pumps. We have to heat and cool water. We have to use a lot of city water, keep power on all the time. So, you know, certainly there's some costs that don't ever change.
Not to mention all the herring and squid you have to buy for the dolphins. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on a Thursday afternoon in Baltimore. Today, the Dow gave up 443 points, 4.8%. The Nasdaq tumbled 72 points, 4.3%. The S&P 500 sank 47 points. That's an even 5% there.
Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. Special thanks today to the staff here at WYPR. Coming up next time on the program, the delayed gratification of layaway.
When I do finally get that item, it's mine. It's paid off. That makes me feel a lot more responsible and more grown up than when I was 18 years old and I was buying things on credit cards that I couldn't pay back.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow back in Los Angeles.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.